The final speaker for the WKU Library's 2016 spring season of We've Been Everywhere is Dr. Brian Coots, Department Head of Library Public Services. His presentation is Bali, the Land of Many Gods. Brian has visited Southeast Asia, including Bali, part of Indonesia, in recent years with his daughter Megan. Ken Fushi, chair of the We've Been Everywhere program, presides over the event.
Today, beginning from the airport, up the Dent Bazaar, over here in Ubud, the intellectual capital of the country and the former home of the King of Ubud. And then we will find our way along the road up here to some of the sacred temples up here. We'll take a second trip up to Mount Agung, to the most holy of the Hindu temples. We'll take a trip up here to several of the lakes. We'll take a trip here down to Sanur and over to Uluwatu. I have not been in this section of the country. People tell me there's not much there, although there's a large national park up there. Just a brief bit of history relating to Bali. We now know, I've just been reading one of my best reference books last year, the Cambridge Encyclopedia of Prehistory, a fairly good database on DNA evidence and archaeological evidence that what we now call early anatomically modern humans moved out of Africa in a series of waves. We now use this dating term KYA to stand for 1,000 years ago, rather than writing it all out. And we typically archaeologists are using CE for the Common Era, which we now used to call AD. So before the Common Era and the Common Era. So in one of those treks from Africa, we have a group of people entering Bali for the first time, crossing the Lombok Strait, across the famous Wallace Line, and eventually reaching Australia. The earliest archaeological ruins then show that extensive trade was going on with places like Vietnam into Bali and from India. And toward the beginning of the Common Era, as you can see, the first contacts between China and India were intensified on long-distance trade between the island of Bali and India. And we do have the appearance of Indian commodities and that began appearing in Indonesia. Around the 4th century CE or AD, the first Hinduistic kingdom was established in eastern Borneo. When looking back in history, or certainly with the assistance of the Dutch as they wanted to recreate Balinese history, they referred to the period roughly from around 1343 until about 1600 in the arrival of the Dutch as the golden era or the florescence of Hindu culture in Bali. And in 1343, we get the establishment of the Majapahit Empire. They subdue the Balinese and establish their kingdom in Bali. And so most of our Hindu religion and our Hindu customs trace their development and their establishment from this period. As the Majapahit come under increasing pressure from Islam, and eventually the empire collapses, before it collapses, most of the intellectuals from the empire move to Bali. So we have this tremendous cultural tradition established in Bali. With the collapse of the Majapahit, for a while, Bali gains its independence from its Javanese masters in the 16th century, and then we have the arrival of the Europeans, particularly the Dutch. And the Dutch made several attempts to conquer Bali. The Balinese were not very receptive, and eventually the Dutch decided just to leave this problem kingdom alone. And to leave it in the hands of the Arab and Chinese traders. Sometime in this period, then, the very large kingdom of Bali, referred to as the Gelgul Kingdom, fractures into 9 smaller kingdoms, and the government system today is based on those 9 smaller kingdoms, now referred to as the regencies, each one of which had its own king. But we think of the Balinese as being the peace-loving, and when you ask people about Bali, everyone comments about such a smiling and happy people. But it's based on a very warlike tradition. They fought incessantly for 500 years, massacred lots of their fellow Balinese. So it's a very much an image cultivated for the tourists, I think, in the 21st century. During the 18th century, the French, the Dutch, and the British all tried to establish treaties with the Balinese kingdom. The Dutch attacked several of the Balinese kingdoms in the 19th century and occupy a portion of Bali. But it's not until really between 1906 and the 1908 that the Dutch seriously conquer and take over administrative control of Bali. And it remains in Dutch hands until the invasion of the Japanese in 1942. So it's part of the greater Dutch East Indies. We have 3 years of Japanese occupation. One of the things the Japanese do is before they leave, they throw their support to soon-to-be President Sukarno. And with Japanese assistance, he'd been in internal exile, he becomes the first president of Indonesia, and Bali becomes a province within this new country of Indonesia. The Dutch did not go willingly, and a whole series of civil wars and battles are fought from 1945 to 1949, guerrilla war, a lot of people are killed. The last of the surviving kingdoms subdued in 1908, the Klung Kung Palace, the Kingdom of Klung Kung, which is southeastern Bali. This is a preserved meeting room. The king would have sat here, the prince, some of the legal assistants, and if you were a petitioner, you might be sitting on the floor on the side petitioning the king for some kind of redress. All of the artifacts from those period of battles between 1906 and 1908 are preserved in this museum. The entire royal family of Klung Kung marched out to meet the Dutch and then promptly committed suicide. The entire royal family of Klung Kung eliminated, and some people think this swayed the Dutch to perhaps provide less restrictive government, less harsh conditions for the Balinese. In 1963, that very large mountain we saw in the first slide, the Mount Mantagung volcano erupted, killing thousands on the island of Bali. And the lava and some of the material coming out flowed over the hillside and created a very verdant area now where this Balinese coffee that you've been drinking has now been cultivated and grown since 1971, referred to as the Bali Blue, I think, with the coffee imported from Jamaica. Bali had not really been on the tourist map just for well-heeled intellectuals until 1971, 1972, when this famous film, The Morning of the Earth, which is shot in Uluwatu on the south coast by Albi Falzone, and he intended this as a kind of a personal statement about there's an idealistic world in which the surfers of the time lived in harmony with nature, and this began, once the film became spread, we won't say it went viral, but it became popular in surfing sets and began attracting huge numbers of surfers to, and I'll show you a clip. In 2002, on October 12th, just a year and a day after 9/11 in the United States, Islamic terrorists set off two bombs in nightclubs in Kuta, and killed more than 200 people, is the worst recent disaster. And in the course of a single day, destroyed the tourism business in Bali for almost the next decade. So it's enormous. So many people were affected, in addition to those killed, and the number injured, that they were all airlifted back to Melbourne in Australia for burn treatment. And many of the victims were Australian. In 2011, President Obama visited Bali, and his first sitting American president ever to visit Bali. As you recall, President Obama spent some of his childhood growing up in Jakarta. And to start this, I do want to...
That's true.
This film then going worldwide, then we begin the renaissance of tourism in Bali, and the surfing set, particularly from Australia, but also from South America, began arriving in Bali in enormous numbers. With them all the attendant problems that with the surfers, the introduction of drugs and resulting problems, such that the Balinese and the Indonesians made even the possession of small amounts of drug subject to execution. So we've just had a recent case in Bali, three Australians having introduced drugs and into Bali, all of which were executed, despite the protests from the... So very harsh penalties for introduction of drugs to Bali. The government of Bali today, we mentioned Bali being a province of Indonesia, is divided into regencies and cities. There's only one city, Denpasar. All of the former kingdoms from that slide we showed you are now regencies. Each regency is headed by a bupati. Each city is headed by a mayor, a wali kota. And so the chief form of government, most of the administrative structure, are based at this level of regencies and city mayors, very similar to our own city mayors. These are the regencies of, so we can see Denpasar, the only city. We talked about the kingdom of Klongkong right here. We saw the surfer film down here. The southernmost tip of Uluwatu, when you look up off those cliffs, you're looking over here in Java. A lot of people have been intrigued by the calendar of Bali. Bali uses three different calendars. The lunar calendar, sometimes referred to, not really correctly, as the Chinese calendar, based on the changing of the moon, our own calendar, but also what's referred to as the Wuku, or the Balinese calendar, totally unique to Bala. It's based on cycles of 210 days, of weeks varying in length from 1 day to 10 days in rotation. There are auspicious days. You have to consult a priest and consult the calendar to find out before you take any kind of action in Bali. There are good days and bad days for doing everything. And every 15th day is a special day. At certain times of the year, on especially holy days, there's a day of silence when the entire country ceases. Electricity is shut off, the airport is closed, and people spend time in reflection. Tourists are told to stay in their hotel. But you couldn't go far because there's no traffic is allowed on the road. Bali has one of the most benign climates in the world. It's slightly about 8 degrees south of the equator. The temperatures are always beautiful. It never gets below 68 degrees. It rarely gets above the 90s. There is a rainy season. We were there with some rain in December and January. There are mountains of 10,000 feet. There are cooling places to go in the north. The population you can see from this graph I was trying to illustrate is a very young population, so of 4 million people, more than a million are under 15. So enormously young population. For a long time, Indonesia had a very high birth rate that was somewhat more controlled. So just this enormous population, you can see the problems that Bali has to deal with in educating and finding employment opportunities for this huge burgeoning population. This is the kind of population we need in Kentucky. It would solve our education problems for college. Tourism now is really 80% of the Balinese economy, 80%. And even though it's 80%, you can see that really 31% of the people are still involved in agriculture. So most of the money is coming from tourism, and yet a third of the people still involved in agriculture. Other important industries, furniture making. You can buy Balinese furniture in the United States, beautiful furniture. Coffee, we mentioned, one of their leading exports. They've recently discovered gas across the north, just north of the island, and begun further exploration. Tourists come to Bali every month of the year. And you can see from the graph, there's never a month and less than 500,000 tourists are in the country. Incredibly busy tourist business. For a long time, predominantly Australian. It's a very expensive plane ticket to get to Denpasar, but the Chinese and some of the East Asians have now discovered Bali is this great tourist mecca with such a beautiful climate. The main currency of Bali, the rupiah, it takes, and I've brought some examples you can look at after, it takes about 12,500 rupiah to equal one U.S. dollar. So typically the 100,000 rupiah currency bill is the most frequently circulated. It's worth about $8. Hinduism. Everything in Bali revolves around Hinduism, and it's slightly different from a very unique form of Hinduism, again traceable back to the Majapahit. A visitor from the Hindustan Times recently wrote an article about visiting Bali and was struck by some of the differences in some areas it was more Hindu than India, and other areas, particularly in the diet. He was shocked. It was they're not vegetarians in Bali. They consume beef, and the cow is not sacred. But that being said, more than 90% of the population are Hindu, and Hindu practices govern all aspects of belief of Balinese society. Balinese, it says Hindus perform Trital Sandhya, reciting prayers every day at 6, at noon, at 6 p.m. We've alluded to the famous Day of Silence, when everything on the island comes to an absolute stop. Each Balinese, and I think the reporter from India was struck by how large each home has an open-air temple, often larger than the main living area. He was comparing this to India, where you might have a very tiny space reserved, but in Bali, these open-air home temples are quite large. And flower offerings are made to these temples within the home two or three times a day. There are more than 600 priests. There is a caste system in Bali, somewhat different from the caste system in India. There are no untouchables in Bali, and the priests can come from any of the castes. Women can also be priests in Bali, and there are some 400 priests in Bali. Priests perform, as you can see, various kinds of sacrifices. Each of the towns that we mentioned do has at least three temples, and a Brahma temple, usually located in the village center, a Vishnu temple out by the agricultural farms, and a Siva near the cremation grounds. Land in Bali is held communally and does not belong to the individual. And everyone is responsible for the upkeep and maintenance of these temples. There are, someone said, how many temples are there in Bali? And people say there are so many, it's hard to fathom a count. So there are thousands of Hindu temples in Bali. There are, however, six on most people's list of the most holy or sacred temples in Bali. From the word sa, meaning six, they're not always the same six. But the mother temple we're looking at here at the Vesakhi temple, again near the edge of Mount Agung. We trekked up a very long road straight up at 90 degrees, and we arrived at the temple on a holy day, and you can see a lot of the adherents have been walking a very long distance to get to the temple. This is a typical, and we'll take a look at temples in a minute. That's Megan coming through one of the gates to one of the sections of the temple. So Balinese temples, that's one of the main reasons why, if you're not going to surf or sit on the beach, you're going to Bali to visit Hindu temples. And tourists are invited to participate in these ceremonies, unlike in some countries. So they welcome your participation, whether it's a cremation ceremony or any kind of religious practice. They encourage tourists to participate. So we mentioned the word pura. Temple, kind of these temples typically are just divided into three different zones, and you can see the Nista Mandala is the outer zone where most of the people kind of open field.
Keep your voice up.
The Madhya Mandala is the, if I could say, in the middle zone, and then at the extreme rear of the temple, the Uttama Mandala is the holiest and most sacred zone. It contains usually the lotus throne of the highest god. There are two types of gates. We just saw in the previous picture the split gate, and there are also roofed tower gates, and we'll get a look. This is, we saw the holiest of the Hindu temples along Mount Agung in north central Bali. This is another of the top six among the holy temples. This one is in Goa Lawa, along the eastern coast, and it's famous because it's the only temple inside a bat cave. And you can see we're looking into. We've arrived in the day of celebration, a holy day, and offerings are being made for the various gods. And you can see back here, the bats are really flying around. They never come out of the cave. And so I go up Lawa. It's a really quite beautiful ceremony that I was struck by. So we have the top six temples, we have the other temples, and then we have a whole different class of temples in Bali called water temples. There are water temples throughout the country. The water temples are used for controlling the irrigation system. So we are here at one of the famous water temples. There are ponds with fish, and in behind this there are bathing ponds, purification ponds for cleansing the body before proceeding in the temple. You'll note that as you enter the temples, you have to have suitable temple garment, and they provide the garments, so that you must have no open shoulders, you must wear one of these saris, and so as you enter, and then suitably attired with the special sari as well. So all of these are provided as you enter the temple. Some of these temple complexes, we're looking at one building. There may be as many as 18 separate buildings in some of these temples. On some of these temples, there are 70 ceremonies, special days at these temples in a single year. So there is constant activity. We mentioned the six holy places. We've seen two of the six holiest temples, and we're now going to take a look at where that film was shot of the surfers just off the coast of Uluwatu. It's a sea temple. And beginning in the 16th century, Majapahit Brahmin from Java, named Niratha, wanted to honor the gods and constructed a whole series of sea temples around the entire coast of Bali. And it said you should be able to look from the top of one of these temples, sea temples, into the next sea temple from the highest point.
Wow.
And we are now at the temple of Uluwatu. It's an extraordinary experience to move up amongst these cliffs. The cliffs are inhabited by monkeys, and the tour guide assures you, please don't bring glasses or sunglasses or cameras, nothing. And we were there with a group of Japanese tourists and did not heed the advice of the promptly the woman beside me just lost her her glasses, someone else lost a camera. The tour guides are trained to bargain with the monkeys. So once they've got your stuff, they want the food, not the stuff. So here we are, I'm watching the tour guide, and they're throwing one banana, and the monkey's just looking at the tour guide, and the second banana, after three bananas, the monkey tossed back the camera. The desire is if you're in Cambodia at Angkor Wat, you want to get there at sunrise. If you're in Bali at Uluwatu, you want to get there for sunset. And thousands of people begin arriving in buses, local pilgrims, to experience the incredible sunset from Uluwatu looking across the Java Sea. We mentioned that 80% of the economy is now dominated by tourism, but the traditional economy was largely a rice-growing economy. This is one of the most photographed sites in Bali. It's the Jatibui rice terrace cultivation introduced by the Dutch from their long experience in Holland and how to make effective works. These are controlled from the temples by the temple priest. And the water at varying times is allowed to flow down, and everywhere that is not occupied by a hotel is cultivated with rice. And they are spectacularly beautiful. And they're hard to get to. You could only get, so that it's not as if a lot of people would be around. We were there just ourselves after wandering around these mountains. That's, rice cultivation in the field. This is the rice getting stooped and ready for harvest. There's a temple just behind here dedicated to the gods of agriculture. People are praying to for a bountiful harvest. One of the other big industries I mentioned once the eruption of Mount Agung, coffee was introduced to Bali. Megan and I spent a day at a coffee. This is a coffee and cacao plantation. This is cacao or coca bean. We are looking here at the Kopi Lawa, this extravagantly expensive coffee. Wild civet cats are allowed to explore the coffee groves. They consume the coffee beans, they poop them up, and these are collected, and that's what we are looking at. These are collected and cleaned and marketed in the United States and in Britain at some $50 or $60 an ounce.
What's that white on the side? What is that?
Well, I don't know. I think over here, this is a cacao bean, a very long one. So a lot of concern by environmentalists that these civet cats are being kept in cages to poop out these. A lot of people are putting the nicks on this rather strange form of bitter coffee. I wasn't too impressed when I had it.
That's not what you have over here, right?
No.
Okay.
Bali has a long tradition dating from the 16th century Indian culture, a tremendous tradition of painting, furniture, wood carving, and we spent a whole day at a fine arts cooperative and looking at all of these wonderful, spectacular carvings and paintings, just hundreds of them. The other reason, if you're not surfing or touring temples, you're bound to be wanting to see Balinese dance. It's the most famous dance in the world, and people, one of the first things that you do is to arrange to see Balinese dancers. There are Balinese dancers in virtually every single major village. Three different kinds. We're going to take a look at Kekak dance, and Megan and I sat to watch some of these dances the first night. And it might need your help to start this next slide. Yeah. Give you an idea of the well, you get the idea that these are extraordinary dances. Go on for about more than sometimes an hour and 20 minutes. The story of Ramayana from Hindu culture. People go to Bali because, of course, they have extravagant hotels, beautiful restaurants. It's like traveling to so you have traditional culture, but then just extraordinary. We're staying, Megan and I stayed at the Tanjung Sari. It's one of the oldest hotels in Sanur along the southeast coast, owned by a family of Indian heritage. By law, no hotel can be taller than a palm tree, so there are no large buildings blocking the beaches, so you always have a spectacular view of the beach. And you can see we're here. This is our room, a room like this, not that expensive by American standards, maybe $179 a night, complete with outdoor lanai, and we're in fact staying in the whole compound. And the beach, I was struck by being there in December and absolutely no people. The Australians must be staying home for Christmas. So just us and...
That's right.
People ask, what do people in Bali eat? Well, it's a very international cuisine, but particularly they eat a lot of Indonesian food. And virtually for every morning for breakfast, the nasi goreng, which is kind of an Indonesian fried rice, including chicken and shrimp, always topped with an egg, and usually some spicy peppers. Fried fish, you can see them bringing the fish in, so lots of fish dishes. This is the famous, we get here, the Indonesian satay with the peanut sauce and fresh fruit, people go to Bali to attend cooking schools. There are dozens of cooking schools around the country, so if you have lots of time and money, you can learn how to cook all these wonderful dishes in Bali. Fading into the sunset, looking again from the cliffs of Uluwatu across the Java Sea to Java. And can we get you through the lights? And if you were interested, we'll just send us around. This is, again, 100,000 rupee notes, so about $8. 10,000. When you get down to the coins, they're not worth very much. They're famous for their wood carvings. My tour guide said that Megan and I were leaving, rushed up with this wood carving that's super valuable. But there are so few trees left in Bali for furniture making now that most of the lumber is imported. But of course, all the wood carvers are involved. They do elaborate pictures of various Hindu gods and others, typically made out of hibiscus wood. This is a wood carving made from hibiscus. And they're famous for their batik, so they're making countless ready-made saris and scarves. I brought Peggy a tablecloth, so they're constantly. Any questions? Yes?
I'm curious to know if the dances are often or always accompanied by such a large chorus of people.
They are usually 50.
50?
That's
fascinating.
Yeah, usually 50. That's true. Where these Balinese dances come from, some people argue that when the Dutch really conquer Bali, finally in 1906, 1908, the Dutch were unhappy with the current state of Balinese culture at the time. It was too modern, they said. They wanted the Balinese to look back to the golden period. And a lot of these dances, I think developed, I don't think, scholars think, are kind of seen through Dutch eyes from the 1930s as they thought they might have been in the 16th century. Yes?
There's a famous recording that was made, I think it was released from 1960 on Nonesuch Records. It's probably the most famous Nonesuch record ever produced, which is of on location recording of the Ramayana monkey chant, which in some respects put Bali on the map in terms of the Gamelan type of music. Well, I don't know if we have it in question or not.
These dances are quite animated, so if you can imagine, you're sitting in a circle as a tourist of chairs, just like one of these chairs, around these dancers, and in the center, after some of these battles take place, then enormous fire of burning wood is sitting here. And then people begin walking across the burning embers. And if you don't think they're hot, they began kicking these burning timbers out of, under your chair. The woman sitting next to me practically had a conniption because this large chunk of burning coal is sitting under our chair, but keep your attention. A lot of famous people have been to Bali. Charlie, as you know, a world-class expert on Alfred Russel Wallace. Alfred Russel Wallace visits Bali and crosses the Lombok Strait in 1856, and the line, the famous line referred to as the Wallace Line, is the line just to between Bali and the next island over, the Lombok. And it's the line that divides, Charlie, am I right, Australian animals and fauna, or flora and fauna?
Well, everything, yeah.
Everything. That's where typically Asian culture begins, and on the other side, Australia. Yeah. Margaret Mead, as if you're an anthropology student, visited here and did all these experiments in the 19th, set up her cameras with her third husband, Bateson, and began analyzing the behavior of children based on a study on Mount Agung. Some of her stuff has been debunked since that time. Yes?
The ornate temple gates, are they wooden?
They're
stone.
Is there a fence along that sea temple?
There is not a fence.
Because it looked like a
yes,
sheer drop.
It's a long drop down those cliffs.
They lose many tourists.
You know, not that they have to stay here.
They'll tell you about.
But,
it's funny that she asked that, because the last time I was at the Grand Canyon, at every cash register was a book about the people who've fallen into the canyon.
You have to pace yourself. A couple of the temples are so high up. One day, a couple I just told Megan and the tour guide, who was 95 degrees, and my heart was done. I thought, I'll send Megan up. I don't think I can get to the top of this temple. It's so high.
What's the elevation?
It's as low, when you're at the very tip of Mount Agung, you're about 10,500 square feet up. Of course, the sea level at the bottom. Yeah. Yes?
You mentioned in the middle there somewhere about the land ownership system, the communal one. Do you have any...
In the villages.
Do you know anything about when that started?
It seems to have been certainly from the 20th century, whether it was always that case. They had a lot of strange customs. I asked my tour guide if I was holding him up from eating dinner, and he said, we do not eat meals together as families in Bali. We eat. When the children get up, they eat together. We never get together for meals. There's no family dinner hour, family lunch hour. The Balinese traditionally live in walled compounds, and we toured lots of these. And when you're married and you have a child, you're in the first room, and as the child gets older, the woman and the child move around the compound. And in death, at the end, the most reverential space is a bed, which I accidentally sat on. Someone said, no, that's only for the dead. You're laid out before the cremation ceremony, and the kitchen for these compounds would be on the far right.
Do they avoid the Muslim invasion because they're so far south, do you think?
I think they were a bit isolated, Leslie.
Sharks around there?
Whether it was animals or... if you're not a Hindu in Bali, I think figure the population 90% Hindu, 6% Muslim, maybe 1% half Christian, and maybe 0.5% Buddhist. So you would... Somebody said, would you be allowed... You would probably not be allowed to live in one of those villages if you were not practicing. And so most of the non-Hindu population would live in maybe tourist zones like Kuta along the west coast.
Brian, did I hear you said that this was out of hibiscus?
That's what someone told me, yeah.
Because, of course, in our climate, we can never get a hibiscus to be large enough to carve something this
tree. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yep. Two different colors of hibiscus. Any other questions?
Do you know if they were affected by the Boxing Day tsunami?
They were not affected by the tsunami, and they attribute that to the fact that this is a holy place and that they have managed to avoid these things that have been hitting other countries, because They are holy people. They've been protected.
It's going to surprise you, it's so late.
Well, if there are no further questions, thanks. And I certainly want to take this opportunity as we move toward the end of the semester to thank all of you and all the departments for another great year and wish you a great summer ahead.